So Fred Smith, who started FedEx, popularized this term, discretionary effort. And what he said is, we pay people for a certain amount of effort. And if they kind of fall below that threshold, they're eventually going to get fired. But what we actually need for performance is much higher than that minimum. That gap is at the employee's discretion. It's like discretionary income. That's like you choose. So why does an employee give that? And it is a gift. Why does an employee give more than they're paid for?
One, two, three, four.
Welcome to the Emotional Intelligence Podcast, a podcast where we explore the intersection of emotional intelligence and leadership. And whether you're a seasoned executive or just starting out in your leadership journey, we're going to share practical tips, inspiring stories, and expert insights to help you develop your emotional intelligence and achieve your goals. So sit back, relax, and get ready to take your leadership skills to the next level. I'm Ismail.
And I'm Samir. All right. Welcome, everybody. We have a very special guest with us today, Joshua Friedman, who serves as the CEO of 6Seconds, a global nonprofit organization that's dedicated to the research and application of emotional intelligence. Joshua has authored and co-authored several books on emotional intelligence, such as At the Heart of Leadership and Inside Change, providing actionable advice on implementing EQ in various settings. Joshua is a sought-after speaker and workshop leader, offering talks and training sessions at conferences, corporate events, and educational institutions globally. And through his work, he's advocated for the inclusion of emotional intelligence in educational curricula and organizational culture, promoting EQ as an essential skill set for the 21st century. I think after hearing that introduction, it makes perfect sense why we invited Joshua Friedman onto our podcast. We are very, very excited to have you. Thank you so much for joining. How are you today?
I'm fantastic, and I'm very much looking forward to our conversation.
Fantastic. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. It's very much so appreciated. Just to start us off, maybe you could tell us just a little bit about yourself, a little bit of background, and then also, I'm very curious about the name of the organization, 6Seconds, and the history behind them.
Well, I'll start with the history. Back in 1997, we were sitting around the kitchen table at Annabelle Jensen's house. And Dr. Jensen, we call her Annabelle Research Says Jensen. And we were saying, okay, so we're going to start this organization about emotional intelligence. What should we call it? Now, remember, 97, the internet was brand new. There was like nothing on the internet about emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
Dan Goleman's book had just come out that really launched this concept into popular spaces. And in the book, he'd written a chapter about self-science as one of the models of how you actually develop and grow emotional intelligence. And we had all been part of the school where self-science was developed and involved in that. And we wanted to create an organization that was going to really help people actually put it into action. And so we were trying to come up with names. And I was advocating for platypus.
All right.
I'm glad I lost.
Can we ask why platypus?
Well, they're unusual and creative, and they're very loyal. They're very very family oriented, good family values in among the platypi.
So you were going for more of like a mascot theme than.
And at one point, Annabelle said, "Well, you know, research says that when people are trying to manage emotions, it actually takes about 6 seconds to transform an emotion." And sometime later, we were talking about some other name, an idea, and a little bit randomly, Annabelle says, "Well, you know, I just read this study that it takes 6 seconds when somebody is listening with compassion. It takes 6 seconds for the other person to feel that compassion." And somebody said, "Oh, so it takes 6 seconds to manage anger, and it takes 6 seconds to create compassion." And somebody else said, "Oh, we should be called 6 Seconds." Now, one of our early advisory board members was Dr. Candace Pert, this phenomenal neuroscientist who discovered a lot about how emotions actually work in our brains and bodies. And Candace is the one who told us that emotions actually at a neurobiological level, they're like little keys that go running around looking for matching locks, delivering their messages inside our brains and in every living cell in the human body. And they're there. They're part of our regulatory system. And even that CFO who's like, let's just leave emotions out of it. And kind of really emotional in the way that comes across.
Right? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Those emotions are there. They're driving every thought, every decision. They're like the glasses. Hey, all three of us are wearing glasses. It's like the glasses that we wear, that emotions change what we perceive and how we assess information. But each little bit, each little emotion key lasts for about 6 seconds. And that neurobiological basis is what led us to say, I happen to have a prop. You have a whole basket of little cool keys on my desk to remind me.
And so when you talk about it impacts like the keys in all of our cells and everything, I'm going to make an assumption here. That's probably why we feel our emotions are, you know, we may not, you can look at someone and be like, oh, they look like they're stressed out. Is that part of the reason why, like they're having this feeling, but it's also having this neurobiological impact, this physiological impact?
Absolutely. And in English, we use the word feel, right? It's like, oh, this pen feels smooth. You know, this emotion feels spiky, whatever. What's happening probably is that these emotions, they're produced in our brains primarily, but also in our rounds of heart and our guts and our spines and really all over our body. So little emotion chemicals are running around. They're affecting every living cell in the human body. And as those emotions start to kind of build up, and there's something called a cascade effect where they start multiplying, they physically change us and they change our heart rate. They change, you know, our palms sweating. They change our jaw clenching. They change the butterflies in our stomach, right? But actually, they change all of our bodily systems, including our brain, which is part of our bodies. They change everything, and we start to physically feel it.
And so, as we mentioned in our pre-chat, Samir and I are both kind of from the corporate world, and we've leveraged, we'll say, innate and probably some of our learned emotional intelligence skills, you know, to do what we do, and hopefully what we do is really good, you know, from the in the eyes of our employees and such.
I can measure it if you want.
I see. I noticed on your website you have several assessments. We should get into that. But I'm curious, where do businesses go wrong with emotional intelligence? What are some of the things that they can or do to fix it?
I'm feeling a little cynical today. I'm like, there's so much that they do wrong. I've been talking about the global human energy crisis at work. And another term is emotional recession. People are suffering. We have people in our workplaces all over the world saying, you know what, I don't want to be here. And the large majority, I mean, however you measure it, as much as 78% of people are like, I don't really want to be at work today.
And does this go beyond the pandemic?
Well, it seems to have gotten worse. I think part of it is for a lot of people, I don't know if you guys experienced this. I experienced this where there's certain things where in the last year or so, I've kind of gone back to do X, whatever it is. And like, I don't know that I really want to keep doing this. You know, it's just normal before the pandemic. And then it's like, So I think there are a lot of people who, where they kind of had at least a small break or a big break or a disturbingly big break from, you know, what was normal. And then that's caused a lot of us to question, should we be doing it the way we were? It was normal that good? You know, and there's just so many like toxic workplaces, and BS and like, really? You want me to do this with like the vast majority of my waking life?
Yeah. So how can businesses then battle against this overarching sentiment, right? Like, I mean, the work needs to go on, the business needs to continue to run. And it feels like people are, they're, they, with the pandemic, although we call it the lockdown, right? there was also a lot of freedom gained by it, right? Like as somebody who did a 90-minute commute each direction on a metro train for a decade, right? Like the feeling of getting my time back, the feeling of the flexibility that came along with that, it made me reevaluate everything, like you said. Like, you know, it made me question how I even did it for so long, you know? And I think that there was an awakening in that respect by the entire workforce through the pandemic as like a stop, pause, let's recalibrate our personal expectations, our personal desires. But how do businesses combat with that, right? Like that, how do they respond in an effective way?
I guess the first question is, do business leaders, do senior executives see a need to do that? And we kind of see a couple different narratives playing out, you know, in the headlines right now. I'm not going to throw anybody under the bus, but I see in certain sectors, I've been seeing some headlines like, it's time to get serious again. You know, it's time to, for the grind, or, you know, they probably don't say the word grind, but that's what they mean, right? Like, it's time to be miserable at work again and put in those 15-hour days, right? Interestingly, the statistics seem to be that more kind of privileged white men, people who look like me, are kind of more excited about going back to the office. And the more marginalized somebody is, the less excited they are about going back to the office. I think that should tell us something. Anyway, I'm seeing kind of two narratives. One narrative is we need people back in the office. We have to get back to it. Right. And then the other narrative is, oh, we learned some things in the last 3 years. Let's apply what we learned and let's do things differently. And I would say if you are pounding your head against the wall of saying, like, I want to go back in time, that's not a winning strategy. So I think that's the first thing is, like, let's confront reality. It is no longer 1980, right? And the way we need to think about our work and our leadership, it's time to update it. And what's interesting is there's this large body of research that says when we update how we think about leadership and the culture that we're trying to build, we get better results. And so I think that it's, you know, it's not simply like, oh, grasp in the dark, try something new. There is a lot of evidence out there about what works, but going back in time doesn't. And so I'd say that's the first kind of threshold to cross is, are you willing to confront reality and say, it's time for us to rethink how we do our work and how we do our leadership? And if not, like, go listen to a different podcast because you will not like the rest of this one. Sorry, I just lost you like two listeners.
The cat's out of the bag, right? The cat is out of the bag. People see the value of, we'll say, I don't want to say softer side of things, but like this foundational human aspect of people taking care of people. Actually, people will say taking care of themselves, but like you had said, these companies have done things a certain way for so long. I don't think they know how to do them any different. And as you were saying, like acceptance, it's like the first thing that, you know, for you to seek help and improve, the first thing that you need to do is accept you have a problem, sort of thing. And it sounds like we're not even there yet.
Well, I mean, I'm seeing everyday headlines, you know, like, oh, it's time to go back. You
know, yeah, like, yeah.
Guys, let's think about it.
Right. And so if, let's say there's a company from your sort of expert position, like having consulted companies for a very large number of years, like if a company is grappling with that decision, right? Like how can they become self-aware, like as a company and really recognize like, hey, are we doing this for the right reason? Are we really just bringing people back because we think it's necessary? Like that the collaboration is crucial to the success of our organization? Are we doing this to get some of the power back? Or how would you consult a business that's grappling with this decision right now?
I'd say with kind of every decision that we should get some data. And there's a broad business case. We can look around the world and we can see companies that are doing X, Y, and Z are doing better. But does that really apply to you? And so within your organization, what is the value you're trying to create? What is your strategy for that value creation? And then what is the culture that's going to support that strategy and align with that strategy? And can we measure that? And the answer is yes. Can we measure that and connect the dots to see for you what will be valuable in terms of culture and people? What kind of talents do you actually need? What kind of culture do you actually need? Is it, how important is trust in your organization? And one of the big mistakes that I see, I recently saw an article which was saying, yes, everybody needs to go back to work. We can see the data shows that productivity is better when people are in the office. Now, go read the fine print. And what the fine print is, this was a study of software engineers at a kind of lower level engineering shop in India, where there was not a lot of creativity. There was a lot of code generation. And the metric was, how many lines of code do you write? And yes, working from home in that context was less productive. So now, does that mean that, you know, this supposedly super innovative problem-solving organization is having lower productivity with work from home? Or do you really believe that those two, that the data in this context applies in this context? You know, I think we need to look at, well, what do we mean by work, and what do we mean by productivity, and what are we trying to do, and who's here? What is the output we're trying to create? In other words, what's our value creation pathway? And then let's get the data and metrics in that context. And so let's build a business case for you. And that is not an expensive proposition. You know, we're not talking about, you know, spending $25 million with a big five consulting firm. Like, let's spend a little bit of money and a couple of months and check who is engaged here. What are the drivers of performance here? How important are things like trust here? Do we have anybody in the organization who's great at this? What's going on where it's working well? And very quickly, we can then build on that data and say, okay, so those of you who are saying, you know, no, this isn't important, you're wrong. We have the data, and it's time for us to double down on what works. I remember I was working with the U.S. Navy, and they're very careful about how expenses get tracked. And I remember, you know, having this conversation with this guy who, like, literally can launch missiles. And I'm like, okay, so they trust you whether to launch missiles, but they don't trust you about a $25 lunch bill. So there's this element about, are we trying to build, again, what is the culture that's going to create the results you want? And there are really good reasons for the Navy to do it the way they do. And there's, you know, that sort of the accountability and rules. There's a lot of reasons for that. But I think in a lot of organizations, there are no reasons for it. It's just like, oh, well, we could measure this. But what is the culture we need? And are you looking for a culture of transaction? Are you looking for a culture of, so Fred Smith, who started FedEx, popularized this term, discretionary effort. And what he said is, we pay people for a certain amount of effort. And if they kind of fall below that threshold, they're eventually going to get fired. But what we actually need for performance is much higher than that minimum. That gap is at the employee's discretion. It's like discretionary income. That's like you choose. So why does an employee give that? And it is a gift. Why does an employee give more than they're paid for?
The things that come to mind are they trust this place. They enjoy what they're doing. They have, there's meaning behind it. A lot of intrinsic.
So whether their badge got swiped didn't make it on your list. And I would go so far as to say, based on my research, that the more we focus on these extrinsic, superficial things, the less engaged people are on those deeper intrinsic motivators. And I'm sure you're familiar with, like, kind of way back machine now, Dan Pink's work in the book Drive. And what they found is that the more people were focused on those kind of extrinsic motivators, the lower performance was in complex tasks. So if you want people to do, you know, and I'll just give you an example. Imagine a classroom, and you say, you know what, it's really important that kids raise their hands. you can get kids to raise their hands, and you can, you know, scold them when they don't, you can reward them when they do, and they will raise their hands. So this kid raises his hand and he has a sort of really silly answer to the question. Okay, but he raised his hand. So we're going to reward him for raising his hand. Okay, was that what we really wanted? Were we really looking for the obedience of raising your hand? Or were we looking for kind of interesting thinking? And the point is that we can, if we focus on the drivers of hand raising, we might actually undermine the drivers of interesting thinking.
I think where a lot of companies fall short is really on that first step. It's the take a look in the mirror and really get introspective about what value are we trying to create and what type of a culture we're trying to create. A lot of times it's just snap decisions. Somebody read an article in the Wall Street Journal, a CEO sees the profits dipping, they see certain things and they, you know, they start to associate that with employee performance, but it could be, you know, customer behavior. It could be industry related reasons, economic, just, you know, at a macroeconomic level, trends and things like that. But the easiest thing to point your finger at is like, you know, getting people back in the office. We got to be able to watch over their productivity. I think you made a really good point about, you know, sure, if people are working in a machine shop and they're churning out widgets, then yes, coming to the office, coming to the factory and doing so is a critical part of their job, you know, but there's a lot of things that can happen, you know, critical thinking type of roles, analytical type roles that there is no value add there.
I have another big question around that, which is like, when we say we want people together, what is it that we're wanting to have happen, right? Are we doing that because it's an easy thing to measure and we think that's accountability? Are we doing it? I've heard people saying, well, that we need, I mean, Apple recently was saying, oh, I wasn't going to throw anybody in the bus, but Apple was recently saying, you know, we need people to come in because that's how the casual conversations happen that lead to innovation. Okay, so if your goal is casual conversation that leads to innovation, yelling at your people and, you know, like, giving them a prize or a punishment, is that really going to lead to that kind of thinking? Is there some other way that would make it so they actually wanted to join in those conversations?
So what would you say to those companies that believe that emotional intelligence is not something that they want to buy into, right? It's not the numbers. It's not the black and white. Like,
can I just say good luck with that?
Yeah. Yeah. And so
how's that working for you?
Right. There's companies that are really struggling with this. So I guess it kind of segues us into the next topic, right? Like which we wanted to cover was basically the generational differences, right? Now we have a whole new workforce that's coming into, a whole new generation coming into the workforce with Gen Z. You got the millennials, you have certain folks that are kind of aging out of the workforce that had a certain type of a working style or their version of emotional intelligence, I should say.
Yeah.
So what are those prominent differences, and how can companies sort of address that challenge today, right? Across generations, EQ challenges.
Samir, would you mind if we come back to that in one moment?
Sure.
So you were sort of kind of going with two questions there. One, which is, what's the business case? So let's just talk about the costs for a minute, because we are in a cost-constrained business environment. And I think there are a lot of business leaders who are like, yeah, I would like to invest in people, but it's not something we can do right now. So I think shifting our perspective from investment into let's control the bleeding. So you're hemorrhaging talent. Your engagement is low. Your employees are not sharing data well. They're not collaborating in the way that you need them to. They're not communicating well. That's damaging your reputation. It's damaging your relationship with customers. It's damaging your ability to attract and engage more employees. So I think getting real about the costs of low emotional intelligence and this vicious cycle that as you start kind of ignoring the toxicity and people disconnect more, communication gets worse, trust gets worse, collaboration then gets worse. And as that all happens, then engagement goes down, more people leave, more people are burning out, and then you have a further decline in your company culture, because your people are like, the good people who can leave, they leave. And so you get into this vicious cycle, and essentially that, like, either we can look at the gain wedge and say, like, how do we increase our collaboration and get people working together and, you know, build better value creation? But we can also look at the pain wedge and say, you're bleeding money right now, and you're bleeding money on the people side of your balance sheet. And if, you know, you look at like Gallup's numbers, where globally only 22% of people globally are actively putting in the effort to create that performance we talked about before, that discretionary effort, that's a huge amount of waste. And I'm shocked at how many companies are like, yeah, well, I guess we'll just tolerate that.
Yeah. What, to those companies, right? If they were to flip the switch and say, you know what, we want to look at EQ, we want to look at the emotional well-being of our workforce and increase that 22% of thriving individuals to 50, 75%. What would you say would be like two or three things they could do as first steps to get started on that journey?
Right. So as I said, the first thing is to make the business case clear internally. And when you're sitting in that meeting and somebody at a senior level says, you know, well, this might be nice to have, but it's not a priority, you need to be able to say that you're wrong. We have the data. This is central to our value creation strategy, and we are doing this. It's not like, oh yeah, if we have time. This is central to our business strategy. Once you've done that, it's actually dramatically easier. The thing is, I find most companies, you know, there are a lot of really smart people. I love working with engineers because, like, once engineers go, okay, this is the constraint, this is the goal, we're going to optimize against that constraint, and they figure it out. Right. So businesses are actually really good at that part of it. But we have to get the map clear. Here's the value creation pathway. Here's what we're trying to optimize. Then we can start building capacity and building capacity, training, coaching. We can start measuring it, and measuring it, you get what you measure. So, okay, we need more trust. Are you measuring it? We need better skills for engaging people, and our leaders need to be better at engaging people. Are you measuring it? So build the capacity, measure what matters, and then integrate it across the system, from the way you're recruiting, you know, to the way you're doing your initial interviews, the way you're onboarding people, the way you're promoting people, the way you're discussing performance. At every step in the employee lifecycle, you can tune up this emotional impact and the development of these skills. I would say coaching is one of the most powerful tools to really shift this, is to integrate coaching strategies in your leadership and to kind of redefine leadership in the way that Ismail talked about, that leadership is a people business. It's not a task business.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. We hope you're enjoying the episode so far. If you want to stay updated on all the latest content and behind the scenes action, be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and several other places by using the link in the show notes. And if it's not too much trouble, we'd love for you to leave a review and share this episode with some of your friends. Your support means everything to us, and we can't wait to connect with you online. Now, let's get back to the show.
So, you know, when we go to the talking about the generational differences, is this... I mean, I don't want to say that I don't think this is a boomer issue, is it? Because are we going to have the next, or even Gen Z coming in, millennials coming in as the new CEOs who are making these decisions? And are they all of a sudden going to snap their fingers and say, all right, the old guard is out, let's focus on EQ now? Is that what could happen? Or is there something else behind it?
So this is a really hard puzzle. To know how much of generational differences are just age, right? And like, I've got two 20 something kids, and I look at kind of the way they engage in the world, and I think, you know, some of the way they engage in the world is really different than my friends and I did when we were in our 20s. But some things are just like, yeah, that's part of being in your 20s, right? So like wanting change, willing to take some risks, trying things. maybe some of that is just being in your 20s. What's disturbing and I think important in our research is we're seeing certain things going on in Gen Z, which seem strange for people in their 20s. So, for example, I just said this thing about risk-taking. Optimism, I think, is historically a characteristic of people in their 20s. Let's try something new. And what we're seeing among people in their 20s is a level of caution and pessimism. Often we talk about young people are very idealistic. What we're seeing in our data is that we have one of the competencies we measure of emotional intelligence. It's not really idealism, but we call it pursue noble goals. It's about feeling your sense of purpose and putting that into action. Can you actually step forward on purpose? And Gen Z is struggling in that. By the way, everybody in our global sample, and we're just about to release this data across over 140 countries, is the world's largest study of emotional intelligence, a randomized sample. And we've seen bigger shifts this year than in 15 years of collecting this data. And one of the big shifts is in this loss of purpose and loss of optimism. But the younger you are, the more likely you are to be in that depleted state. And that is a crisis waiting to happen. Because if we're counting on these younger people to like bring their energy and bring their optimism and kind of infuse the next stage of change, and they're in this state of depletion, we have a global human energy crisis.
Does the data lend to the pandemic being the driver behind that, or just the socio-political climate at large? Like, do we know why potentially this crisis is, we're on the cusp of this crisis?
I just saw a little funny cartoon meme. There was a picture of a building collapsing, and there was a cat sitting on the building, and it said, "Correlation is not causation." Right. It's like this cat jumped on the roof and the whole thing collapsed. Right. Again, I don't think normal was so great. I think if we go back to 2019, we could see we'd already had a level of loneliness and disconnection unprecedented in human history. We saw stress going up and up and up. We saw a level of complexity and chaos that we could barely manage. And, you know, and we thought it was tough in 2019. And then, you know, the pandemic came along. So, yeah, hold my beer. So I think it was an amplifier, but I don't think it's the cause.
Have you seen over the, you know, over the course of your career, have you seen EQ or those type of skills deteriorating or improving? Or is it flatline?
Ismail, this is a depressing question because I run an organization whose mission is to increase the world's emotional intelligence. And it's not going up in the way that I try to console myself and say, well, if we weren't doing this in 200 countries and territories, think how bad it would be.
Right. You're keeping the world afloat, Josh.
There are a lot of people out there really working hard to grow these capabilities. And whether it's directly, you know, like you guys focusing on EQ, or whether it's more kind of broadly focusing on the skills that support well-being, wellness, human energy, capacity, people leadership, like there's so much good work happening. And yet the countervailing forces are very strong. And those countervailing forces include the pandemic and post-pandemic kind of chaos, social media, the pace of change, polarization. I think climate change is a significant factor. Again, I have 20-something kids. I remember on my older kid's 20th birthday, and we were kind of talking about, oh, what's going to happen, you know, in the future, da da da, and they burst into tears. Like, well, what's wrong? And they said, I don't know if the world will be here in 20 years.
I mean, it's definitely an issue that the younger generation is extremely passionate about, and I think the less it's minimized, or the more it's minimized, just the harder we're making life for them, right? And not acknowledging it as like a significant issue.
Yeah, actually, climate anxiety is now in many mental health guides become a recognized condition. And I think to some degree, if you don't have some level of climate anxiety, you're in denial, right? That's the appropriate reaction to you know, here we are. We just had the hottest summer on record. I just had a meeting this morning with somebody from the UN, and we're talking about the intersection of youth, climate, and emotions. And I can't share yet, but I hope to come back on the podcast next year and we'll be able to share some good news. But I do have some good news about this, which is in this bad news situation, what we are seeing is that emotional intelligence skills have become even more predictive of performance. So it's been valuable since we started doing this research and we published our first business case well over a decade ago. We just published a new business case and we're seeing even stronger correlations than we did before. And I think in part that's increased pressure, increased complexity. Leaders who are really good with people are going to excel even more in these conditions. And employees and companies and investors are going to be saying, I want people like that. I want somebody I can trust. I want somebody who's going to take care of us. But I will tell you from a more emotional intelligence perspective, for at least the last 15 years, I've at some level known and believed that my job as a leader is about people and that the success and growth of the organization, it's about people feeling a sense of ownership. When I ran through that process that I talked about at the beginning and said, okay, so how are we trying to create value? What kind of culture does that? What's needed in order to build that culture? What I said is we need people to feel ownership. This is an organization where our employees, but also our members say, this is my organization. And it's interesting. I get a little thrill when I'm talking to somebody who's like newly involved and they say, well, we need to da 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 da. That has been so much more palpable and clear through the chaos of the pandemic. And there have been, I mean, I've had my just absolutely darkest, most difficult days as a leader in the last 3 years. And it is just so much of it's been horrible and also amazing. And one of the things that's been amazing is how the people that I work with have shown up and said, okay, I'm going to do everything. I'm going to do more than is humanly possible because I care. And so that piece about, like, as I say, I've known it, but I feel it at a level. I've become, I don't know, it's like really planted in me at this point, and I want to hold on to that.
Josh, thank you for being on the show. We really appreciate it. We know that audience members can reach you, for instance, at 6seconds.org. And there's a lot of material that we're going to link to in our show notes. Is there anything that you need to or would like to just share with our audience in terms of where they can reach you, what new things that you're putting out there, or how they can benefit from some of the things that SixSeconds.org is doing, or yourself?
Yeah, so 6Seconds is fairly active on, you know, most social media. I'm personally go on LinkedIn a couple times a day. We have a huge LinkedIn group that's really active and engaged. And so it's a, you know, great place just to kind of get a little inspiration about this stuff. What I would end with is we know these skills are learnable and they're measurable and you can grow. The first step is saying, yeah, I want to do it. And if you've heard anything today, I hope you'll take away that this matters now and you can do it.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of the Emotional Intelligence Podcast. We hope you found it informative and enjoyable. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And if you have a moment, we'd really appreciate it if you could leave a review on your favorite platform. Your feedback helps us improve and reach more people. If you're interested in learning more about the topics we discussed today, be sure to check out the show notes for links and resources. You can find them by visiting our website. And if you have any questions or feedback, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us by email at info@emotionalintelligence.com or connect with us on social media by using the links in the show notes.